In the last church where I was lead pastor before this one, they had a 113-year head start on me when I got there. And they never let me forget that. We had gone there from a mission start like this one, and so it was quite a shock to hear things like, this church has been here 100 years, over 100 years, and we've never done it like that. And all you did was read the scripture. And I was rummaging through some stuff in that building one day, and I came across a 100-year-old document from that church and from the association that it had been a part of 100 years before. And I found in that document a report from the Temperance Committee, among other things. And the next time somebody said, this church has been here 100 years and we've never done it that way, I asked them why they didn't have that Temperance Committee anymore. 100 years ago, they had that. And, well, it didn't go real well, but the point is, traditions are what you want to do. And making it a tradition is a way to excuse doing what you want to do in God's church. They picked and chose over the 100 years. They did what they wanted to, and they didn't want the Temperance Committee anymore, but they did want this other stuff that the Bible didn't call for, and so we had a few conversations about that. Well, this morning I want you to think about that. I want you to think about your belief system and where it comes from. Is there stuff in your belief system that comes from something that somebody made up, or from something that somebody added to the scripture and said, we need to have one of these, and it's been that way for a long time, and you know, you've reached the magical 100-year mark, and so now it's okay? How much of what you believe comes from God's revelation? And how much of what you believe comes from what people want to believe? Now, as you're considering that, I would invite you to look with me at Mark chapter 5. We'll begin reading in verse 35 today. This is the latter part of that story where Jesus raises the little girl from the dead. And in the process of doing this, he confronts the emptiness and the hypocrisy of human traditions, particularly religious human traditions. Mark chapter 5, we'll begin reading with verse 35. While he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, do not be afraid any longer, only believe. And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. They began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately, the little girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old. And immediately, they were completely astounded, and he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this, and he said that something should be given her to eat. Now, this man Jairus was certain that his daughter would die. There was nothing any person could do to stop it. No human effort would suffice. There was no hope that the next doctor is going to know what this is and have the cure. They had already done all of that could be done, and she was clearly dying. And so Jairus approaches Jesus as soon as Jesus comes back into that region, and he asks for help. And as we said last time, Jairus had underestimated Jesus' power. Jesus didn't have to be present for the little girl to be healed. He didn't need to lay his hands on her for the little girl to be healed. Jairus asked for those things. All he had to do was will her to live and she would live. But Jairus did believe that Jesus could save his daughter when no normal, mere human could do it. When no human effort would suffice, he knew that Jesus had the power. So he did have real faith in Jesus. It was embryonic, but he did believe, and he approached Jesus humbly, demonstrating his faith with his actions and with his words. But now the news has come. The little girl has died. It's too late. Jesus wasn't back in time. And when the news reached them from Jairus' house, as they were going there, Jesus immediately comforted Jairus. But he didn't comfort him in the way that you would normally comfort someone who is just hit with that kind of horrible news. Verse 36, it says, "But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, 'Do not be afraid any longer, only believe.'" He's telling Jairus that there is still hope. Don't fret over this news. Don't be afraid because of this news that she's dead, because you just need to continue to believe. And then Jesus sends the crowd away, sends most of his disciples away, and he and three disciples proceed to Jairus' house along with Jairus. Now, when they get there, the scene that they encounter is intense, to say the least. Verse 38 sums it up. It says, "They came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing." Now, what was happening at Jairus' house is one of these traditions that people have added to things over the years. It was a religious tradition, but it was a tradition. It's a phenomenon that we have been mercifully spared ever having to deal with. This was part of the religious culture of the Jews of that day. When somebody died, their way to attempt to deal with it was to cry as loud and as long as possible to show everybody how much you cared about this one who had died. Now, this cultural practice of ongoing loud wailing was not in any way commanded in Scripture. Instead, it was something that had grown up out of human traditions that were added to the Scripture. It's the kind of thing that could easily happen gradually. Somebody is particularly outward with their emotions, and they wail and they cry, and then you have a tragedy and you don't want to be outdone, and so you carry on a little longer than you might have, and it just escalates. And over time, this thing had become the deal. I mean, you had to do this way. And the people in this story, it had fully developed by this time. These are hired mourners who are doing the crying. You know, you can only keep this up for so long, and some people are better at it than others. And if you really love your loved one, you want to bring in the best. And so these people did this for money. For a fee, they would come in and cry in your living room for hours and hours. If the price is right, they're there to create a commotion to demonstrate to all of your neighbors how much you care. And this was something that everybody did at that time. One ancient Jewish document stated that the poorest husband in Israel should hire not less than two flutes and one wailing woman when his wife dies. Now, this was not a poor man. Jairus was a ruler of the synagogue. He was an important person, and you have to figure he hired more than the minimum compliment. You got wailing women competing with each other for the tip. Somebody had taken care of this while Jairus was gone. He either made the arrangements or some steward had rushed out and gotten the best wailers in the community to come in. And when they get there, it's already going on. In the prescribed pattern of loud carrying on. Now, this little spectacle gives some insights into the shallow nature of human traditions. this loud crying that had developed over time as a way to try and deal with the anguish of death had no power to help anybody deal with the anguish of death. It was inherently superficial. It had no ability to give anybody any comfort in their grieving. There was no way that it's going to help anybody deal with the death. In fact, it's just the opposite. How can you think with all of this going on in your house? And houses then were very small, so there's not like the chance to get away from it somewhere. So in the absence of some biblically based theology to deal with death, they carried on very loudly to demonstrate publicly the grief of this family. Now, this tradition is like other traditions, and that what it really came down to was impressing your neighbors. It didn't do anything else, but it could make your neighbors go, "Wow, Jairus spent some money. I mean, he's paying them double time. They've been there a while. Wow, they really, really care over there at that house." At a time when your neighbors ought to be encouraging you, this tradition would have you bound in some attempt to make them think that you care. And this was how they expected you to show it, and so if you didn't show it that way, you don't care. So you want everyone to see how much you care, and you get somebody to cry for you. The whole thing is very empty and superficial. Hiring a stranger to wail for you doesn't demonstrate love for anybody. Why do you need other people to be impressed at a time like that anyway? But that was the culture, and it was the religious culture, and it had a grip on everybody. It was not from God. It was a tradition, but it still controlled that culture. And this is how it is with human traditions. They have no power to help. They have no power to give any comfort. They don't offer any hope. They're usually rooted in pride, as this tradition was. I want you to see what a good person I am, so I'm going to do this. And then beyond all that, there's always inherent hypocrisy in a human tradition. Why don't you have the temperance committee anymore? You pick and choose. And here are the most obvious aspect of the hypocrisy is the actions of the person who has been hired to cry. Now, playing the flute, you can hire yourself out to play the flute in good conscience. A little background music, you know, that's okay. But a wailing woman? You got to figure that the woman who can produce the most volume with the best sense of realism is going to get the best price. That's going to bring a higher fee. But it's a sorry substitute for actual comfort. And isn't crying by definition the last thing you want somebody to fake for you? Isn't that supposed to come from real pain or real anguish? So you'd have to be a little concerned if we lived in a culture like this. You'd have to be a little concerned about the integrity of the person who could hire himself or herself out to pretend to cry, or who could even bring himself or herself to fake this convincingly. But this is the nature of human traditions. There is always hypocrisy. There is always this showiness for other people because we want them to be impressed. But there's no ability to help. No ability to offer any comfort. There's certainly no improved status with God. It's just an appeal to human pride and hypocrisy. And in spite of all of that, which is fairly obvious in this particular thing to us because we didn't always grow up doing it that way, we can't say, well, this church has been there 100 years and we've always had people cry like this. So it's kind of obvious to us in this instance because we don't do it. It's not as easy to see if you've always done it, if you grew up in it, your grandparents did it, and their grandparents did it. Traditions hold a powerful grip on people. It's hard to break free from your traditions. They're not as obvious to you as someone else's are. Jairus, who had enough genuine faith to go to Jesus when people were probably considering him a desperate man for doing so, to humble himself before Jesus, to affirm Jesus' power to help and to ask him for his help. Jairus had that much faith, which is a lot. He gets back home, there's still hired mourners in his house. It's very hard to disconnect the religious tradition from the genuine faith in your practical living of your life. Traditions hold a powerful grip on people. What are other people going to think of us if we don't? That can be a powerful force. And so even thinking through things that we have done all of our lives, that all the people we've known have done, even thinking through that can be hard. And so people don't often even question their traditions. Sometimes they can look right at them and not realize their traditions. And so for whatever reason, whether he hired them or someone hired them for him, Jairus gets home and they're there and they're carrying on. And it's a mess. And when Jesus steps into the home, he just stops and takes it all in for a moment. Verse 38, it says, they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. This word can be uproar. He saw an uproar with much weeping and wailing. They were carrying on, I mean, to beat it all. And the verb translated he saw or he beheld means that Jesus stopped and took in the whole scene. He was standing there beholding this scene. He looked on it with understanding. He stopped and took in the whole mess and watched for a moment. Now, the whole show was painfully shallow and sad. It was not anything that God had ever called for. It lacked any power to help anybody. And it's evident in Jesus' response to these people who are in mid-wail when he comes in that he's not pleased with what he saw. That Jesus does not care for this tradition that has been added to the Scripture. And so in verse 39, he asks a question. Why make a commotion and weep? He's saying this to the people who are making a commotion and weeping. Why do that? Now that sounds harmless enough. It's a simple question. But you can be sure that these hired mourners were immediately put off by that simple question. Because it's a direct challenge to what they're doing and to the belief system that underlay what they're doing. And you've probably noticed this phenomenon. Ask a simple question, make somebody really, really mad. You do it without meaning to. Why does your church have Easter egg hunts? Make somebody real mad, ask stuff like that. Why do you have a God and country rally? Do you really like that double billing? Shouldn't one of those be higher? Why do you use a one-man, one-vote system in your church? Where do you get that? Doesn't have to be about church. You can ask somebody, why do you play the lottery? Why do you have time for all those other things? All of a sudden, somebody's mad at you. All you did was ask why. It's a challenge to those who are not asking why. It's a challenge to those who don't have a good answer to why. And Jesus is doing this on purpose. He's talking to the people who are wailing, saying, why are you doing that? That doesn't help. Why carry on like that? Can be a very blunt challenge. And nobody likes to say, well, because we like this tradition. And in the absence of another answer, they may become offended. Then Jesus says, the child has not died, but is asleep. Now, there's a lot of speculation about what Jesus meant by that statement. Some say that he meant the child was asleep, literally asleep, as if in a coma, a deep sleep. They just couldn't tell. She's not really dead. She's just in a coma. And they prefer to think that Jesus made an astute medical diagnosis without having seen the patient yet. And that the child happened to wake up from the coma while Jesus was holding her hand saying, little girl, I say to you, get up. I think we can kind of rule that theory out. If you want to take the Bible at face value, you still have to answer the question, though. Why did Jesus say she was asleep? We don't have the inflection in his voice because we're looking at a printed revelation. We don't see the expression on his face. And so a very good indicator of what he meant is the reaction of the people who were there, heard it, heard the inflection, saw his face, the people he was addressing, the hard mourners. You can tell something from their reaction that helps you know what he meant. Had Jesus been saying that the little girl is literally asleep and that she would wake up from her sleep, it's very unlikely that they would have reacted the way they did. If they had thought him to mean that she is literally sleeping, there would have been a different reaction. They might have stared at him in wonder. Who is this guy? Has he been in there yet? They might have shaken their heads at his denial of reality. You've seen people who just can't deal with death. They just, oh, no, she's not dead, she's not dead. Can't be. They might have thought he was crazy. But they all knew that she was dead, and if Jesus thought that she was just asleep, they would have assumed that he was in denial. And you don't laugh at someone who's in denial. They would have looked very sad at him and gone, And they would have gone back to wailing because you don't want to mess up an easy gig like this by breaking character. Suddenly, these people who are paid to be there and cry, and this is a cushy kind of a job, you know, you don't have to go out in the heat. And suddenly, they set it all aside and they're mocking him. Not because he was in denial or that they thought he was, saying that she was just asleep. Had they been taking him to mean sleep is a euphemism for death, and as though he were talking about the fact that we'll all see her again. She's not gone forever. It's like she's asleep, and we're going to see her again in heaven. They certainly would not have reacted to that the way that they react here, because this was a religious society. Had they thought that Jesus was making an allusion to the temporary nature of death, they would have muttered back the appropriate platitude, yes, that's right, we'll see her again. And they'd have gone back to crying because you don't want to mess up an easy gig like this by breaking character. No, you have to remember that Jesus had come here to save the day. That's why Jairus went and got him. And many of them may have been thinking, that pathetic man, he is so desperate. Now he's going off chasing after a miracle worker. I mean, I hate that his daughter's dying, but I think he's losing it. Jairus is getting a little irrational. Or they might have thought, yeah, go get him, man. We can try whatever. But whatever they thought, they knew that Jairus had gone to get the miracle worker, and here he is. He's come in to save the day. Now, the messengers who brought the news to Jairus clearly believed that it was now too late. They say, don't trouble the teacher any longer. She's dead. Don't make him come. There's nothing he can do. It's too late. So now the girl's dead. The message has been sent. Go on about your business, teacher. It's too late. Appreciate you trying. And Jesus shows up anyway as the miracle worker. He has come in as the one who's going to save the day. He looks right at the ones who are wailing and carrying on, and he says, what you're doing is unnecessary. Why are you doing that? And then he says, the little girl is only asleep. Now, the people in that room apparently took him to mean that he was still going to save the day. He's saying, I can wake her up. I've come here to fix it. They believe him to be saying that he's going to do just that, that he could fix it. And they laughed him to scorn. They laughed at him with ridicule because they believed him to be saying he had power over this little girl's death. Now, I believe that is exactly what he was saying. I'm going to wake her up. You don't need to cry. I'm going to wake her up. And they understood him perfectly well. They just didn't believe him. And so strong was their unbelief because they were so shallow in these traditions that they broke character. They blew the gig. And they laughed and mocked and ridiculed right in the middle of all the crying. They switched it off. And they're making fun of him for thinking he can still save the day. What kind of kook has come in here? Oh man, yeah, like he's going to raise the dead. Right, you can just hear the hatred in these who had been pretending to cry. They knew what he meant. They understood him. And that is what he was saying. Now remember, all of this is one quote from Jesus. Verse 39, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. He's saying, I'm going to wake her up in just a minute. And so quickly, these filled with hatred let their hatred come to the surface. The girl still lay there dead. And they mock and ridicule and scoff at the Lord of glory because they don't believe he can do that. False comforters filled with hatred and bitterness, putting up a religious facade that is rooted in human tradition. And their response to Jesus' challenge reveals something quite different from what they were pretending. And that appears to be Jesus' very purpose in challenging them before he raised the girl from the dead, to show forth this hypocrisy that is inherent in human tradition, to make clear that there is nothing but emptiness in these vain attempts to comfort with something other than the Scripture and the principles that we get from the Scripture. He's setting the stage for the real comfort that he can give, but it only comes in him. Well, Jesus proves his power. He runs these hypocrites right out the door, takes the three disciples that he had brought with him and the little girl's parents. They go into the room where the girl's body lay, and very gently, he wakes her up. He says to her, Talitha kum, little girl, I say to you, wake up. Get up. Talitha was a word used to describe an infant or a small child. It was a term of endearment that many parents would have used, maybe even in waking their children up in the morning. This girl's about to wake up in a room with four strangers looking down at her with her parents. And Jesus is so gentle and so kind. Baby girl, time to get up. Sweetie, wake up. And he woke her up. Well, they were completely astounded. Jesus ordered them to keep this quiet. He was always having to avoid a mob scene of people trying to make him king. And in this case, these orders were probably just to keep her out of sight until he could get out of town, which he immediately does. He leaves town immediately because you start raising the dead, these traditionalists are going to try to make you king to use you for their political purposes. These fickle, false mourners would have been the first in line to try and force Jesus into a political position to fight against Rome. And so he says, don't let this out. And he and his disciples went to Nazareth right then to get out of town. He'd already sent the crowd away to minimize this. Most of his disciples, he must have sent, we're going out of town in that direction. Y'all get on the road. We'll catch up with you. But he did wake the little girl up. He came in as the miracle worker and did what no one really thought he could do. And this story serves to show a contrast between the emptiness and the hopelessness of human tradition that couldn't even comfort in the midst of grief, and the value of genuine faith that can conquer even death. It's a pretty stark contrast. Now the question for you and me, it's just a matter of different traditions. We don't have this one, but we have ours. And it really comes down to what you hope in. And whether what you hope in can produce any good thing. And the hypocrites in this story were religious. They would all have been able to talk about the Lord. They would all have been able to use the lingo and say how much they longed for the Messiah to come. That would have been a big part of their lingo. When Messiah comes, boy, everything's going to be better. But they were so enamored with things that didn't come from God, things that they had made up, things that they wanted to do that way and were using the test of time as their excuse. They were so enamored with that stuff that they did not recognize the Messiah when he stood in the room with them and said, "Why are you doing that? Why carry on like that?" And they laughed him to scorn. Now, we all have them. We're rooting them out. But we all still have things that we get from our own minds and from the people around us that we don't get from the Scripture. And we need to understand how deadly this is. Human traditions are a danger. They are antithetical to the Christian faith. They keep people from godliness. And the only solution is for believers to test everything by the Scripture. Is it called for in the Scripture? Is there a principle in the Scripture that makes us know this is good? If it's about things that didn't exist then, computers and cars and airplanes and your use of those things, there's still a principle in the Scripture that applies. Do your values come from this book? Or are you doing what you want to do and saying it has to be good because everybody's doing it or we've done it for so long? Is it called for in the Scripture? If not, clinging to it will distract you from your walk with God, and it may keep you from God completely. Traditions are a very dangerous tool in the hands of the devil. They have no value, they have no power, they have no hope. They offer no lasting comfort. They grant no improved status with God. They are always rooted in pride, and they are always filled with hypocrisy. Test everything in your life by the Scripture. Start with what you believe about church. Reject these things that have no basis in the Scripture and hope in Jesus, who has infinite value and who can bring you to God wholly and complete. You think about this extreme case. Somebody's grieving and hurting over a death, and the traditions make it worse. Jesus conquers death, restores to life, grants hope. That's the choice. So I just challenge you to test your belief system. This is an ongoing thing in your life. Day by day, you're reading the Scripture and you read something that makes you go, "Oh, that's not what I always thought." Change what you think. That'd be your cue from God. Now's the time. Let's bow together, please.